Good morning. You're listening to Books for Breakfast on CFRU 93.3 FM in Guelph. It's Thursday, May 3rd, and this town has been touched by the gods of sparkling dew everywhere, sort of post-storm light, and it's a beautiful morning. And we have a beautiful show. This is a book nerd show. I'm your host, Dan Evans, and I'm be joined very shortly by your other co-host, Peter Bradley, who was very busy this week moving his apartment, and I bet you he found a few gems. As one book lover to another out there, you know what it's like to move 100 boxes of books from one apartment to the other. Well, actually, no, firsthand, because I helped him. So it'll be fun to sort of pick his brain a little bit. I got a great package in the mail this week that I want to tell you about, and we also have two interviews lined up today, one with Kate McQuaid from House of Anansi Press. In my books, they are the number one press in Canada. They're doing fantastic work. Started in the 60s. They have amazing pedigree, and we'll talk a little bit about that press with her. Mostly what's going on these days with Anansi. They're expanding their roster. They're adding imprints. Taking over the world. They're doing amazing stuff. You may know that name. You may be thinking, Anansi, why do I know that? It's because the most popular thing that they do these days is support the Massey Lecture with a publication every year. And then we can maybe even talk a little bit about this year's Massey Lecture. After that, it'll be Waterloo, Ontario author Carrie Snyder. She's on talking about her new book. It's a novel in stories called The Juliet Stories. House of Anansi has published it lovingly. It's a gorgeous book, beautifully made and beautifully written. And she's actually going to be in town with last week's guest, Andrew Hood. That'll be Monday, May 7th, just around the corner at the E-Bar. Before we get to all that, though, let's listen to a little music. So thanks for warming up here on Books for Breakfast. This is Rose Cousins.
To know the dark, go into the dark. You can lock the door, yeah, you know how. You can stay alone, you're so proud. But you can't keep the darkness out. Oh, you're probably the strongest one I know. You got the thickest skin, you got weight to throw.
To know the dark, go into the dark.
take a light into the darkness and know the light. To know the dark, go into the dark.
Rose Cousins from her newest release, We Have Made a Spark. That's called The Darkness. Beautiful track. And yeah, welcome back to Books for Breakfast, CFRU 93.3 FM in Guelph. It's always a good morning here, especially a good morning this week, because, I don't know, I've been getting some mail. Peter, do you have any subscriptions? Do you subscribe to anything?
I think they've all lapsed.
Really? Yeah.
Except maybe, I guess I've got one more on Canadian Notes and Queries.
Okay, cool. You're going to have to transfer it over to your new place. Congratulations on moving, by the way. I just wanted to pass off this this beautiful gem and let you salivate while I tell people that I re-signed up for The Walrus. I think that's my second subscription. The Walrus is a fantastic sort of like a Canadian Harper's or maybe a Canadian New Yorker. I think they do their own thing, and I think they'd probably do a more elegant job of explaining it, but... I always loved The Walrus, and I saw in their magazine an offer for a limited edition Margaret Atwood novella, chapbook, I guess.
Signed.
Yeah. It's very limited. I'm unless you find the number, I might not say it. It might be 1,000. Is it numbered in there? And not only that, but it's characters that have actually shown up in one of her books
2,000.
Before. 2,000. Okay, so only 2,000 of those made, and also created at Coach House Press, which is cool.
I wonder if they got this idea from CNQ.
Yeah, because Dan Wells and Canadian Notes and Queries, if you subscribe to that magazine, they promise a chapbook in every issue, which is amazing. In fact, it was the Mike Barnes chapbook in the newest issue, and he's coming to town, on the 14th. Isn't that beautiful? So Margaret Atwood's pamphlet is called I Dream of Xenia, maybe, with the bright red teeth. And that's a character from, I think, Alias Grace. She's extending that. It's actually got a little ISBN, so I'm guessing that eventually they're going to do a mass market. Just listen to this, though. The sound of beautiful pages turning. What a treat in the mail, hey?
My mom did ask me recently, what do you think of The Walrus? I was thinking about subscribing. It's really cheap right now, like $1.50 an issue. And I just feel like there's so much stuff to read that I could never...
Really? You couldn't add to your subscription list?
Well, just... I've never enjoyed The Walrus that much.
No. I like it. I like it. And they do themed issues throughout the year, so...
Sometimes it catches my eye and I think, maybe I would read that. And then I don't.
So... You must have, I was telling listeners just before this that you moved your entire apartment this week and that there were thousands and thousands of boxes and crates of records and books. And or maybe not that many, but...
I have the heaviest move. The average box could not possibly be heavier.
It was heavy, dude. That was heavy stuff. And
I am in pain right now from a week of lugging. I'm living in an attic.
But did you find any gems is the question, because you know, and so do you know out there in listener land that when you have to pack up your collection, whether it's to ship it off to someone else or whether it's just to, you know, store it in the attic for a little while to make more room for more books, you know that you always find gems. You know, you think, how did I get this? I didn't know I owned this. Did you make a pile? Is there a pile?
There's no pile. I'm not certain that I found many surprises. I must have. I think I'll find those unpacking. The packing was such a... The first few days it was very deliberate and smooth and organized, but then it became a mad rush.
Yeah. Well, fair enough. I don't think your boxing was all that bad. I think you did a pretty good job.
I did an incredible job for the first half of for the books and records. Oh, those were well packed.
Well, congratulations. And it'll be fun to sort of decorate your new place with all of your hordes of books. And maybe I'll get you a subscription to The Walrus as a moving in gift. I must admit that I saw that ad and I rushed to the internet and whipped out my credit card because I can't imagine that they're going to be around for a while.
This came with new subscriptions?
Yeah, new subscription. That's the bonus, the Margaret Atwood mini.
That is a great, that sort of... that does kind of seal the deal.
Yeah. So listen, I would be remiss if I didn't remind you, and that includes listeners, that this weekend is TCAF, the Toronto Comic Arts Festival.
Uh-huh.
I'm going to go on Sunday, and I'll report back, just a mini report next week. That means that the Doug Wright Awards, the annual, you know, from within Canada, best publishing in graphic novels in the year, they're awarded on Saturday night, and some of our Guelph-based heroes are there, Brian Munn and Seth, etc. I'm really looking forward to this, and I think you should spend 10 minutes today on the internet looking at the Toronto Comic Arts Festival.
Well, maybe I'll just go.
Yeah. It's all day Saturday, all day Sunday, and they've done one of these almost, it's like they've modeled it on Kazoo Fest or something. it blankets the town. The main headquarters, the main events take place at the Reference Library, and they take up all kinds of nooks at Yonge and Bloor. And they just,
that Reference Library is a pretty neat place.
Oh, it's so cool. Many, many floors of goodness and secrets. And there's little rooms, study rooms, all off the side. So they fill these conference and study rooms, and this is, the program is incredible. You can actually spend a whole day learning technical stuff, like how to ink a panel, or you know, how to change your, if you're just a 9-panel person as a comic creator, you know, how to get out of that mode. So there's all these famous and amazing graphic novelists teaching people how to change their bad habits. But there's also lots of just book signings, and they do these things at Toronto Comic Arts Festival called like draw offs, where it's, you know, Brian Lee O'Malley versus Faith Erin Hicks or something like that. And it's like, go, you've got 15 minutes to draw the craziest dragon in the world, you know, or something like that. So there's plenty of good stuff. I wanted to tell you my highlight of the week. There's this guy, Michel Rebagliati. Have I ever shown you this book?
Isn't he the guy that got busted in Nagano?
Is he?
I'm making Ross Rebagliati
jokes.
Oh, no. 14 years too late.
Yeah, he was a snow surfer for a little while before he became an amazing graphic novelist. One of the most important graphic novelists in Quebec these days. Can I just admit something off the top? I don't know why, but they say he's revolutionizing the graphic novel. Honestly, I don't really know why. His line work is incredible. It's so detailed. He's a good storyteller, and his character is usually Paul, probably modeled semi-autobiographically. Paul has gone to summer camp. Paul has got his first job. Paul has stayed in the city, you know, as a young teen, on his first foray from his parents' home. This one is called The Song of Roland. So it spans a few more eras in Paul's life. And I don't know why he's revolutionizing the graphic novel, except to say that he does make very good, you know, semi-autobiographical books that are spanning a lifetime.
Maybe fans of Essex County, like...
Yes, yeah. Absolutely. Essex County fans, for sure. Finer lines than Essex County, but... great storytelling, same sort of haunted, normal lives. And the other big thing here is that Michel Rebagliati has gone over to Conundrum Press, a little press that'll be at TCAF this weekend, a great little press who I want to catch up with for this show. They moved from Montreal to the East Coast. I'm not sure which city. I don't think it's Halifax, but they've also sort of stopped the literary fiction game, and they're
Greenwich,
getting...
Greenwich, Nova Scotia.
Oh, Greenwich. Okay, cool. Nova Scotia. And now they're exclusively a graphic novels press. Andy Brown, the publisher and founder, has just, you know, made the statement that he sees a real, not a hole, but a real opportunity and a place to be fostered, you know, something to foster something great in Canadian publishing. So look for Conundrum Press. They got a great logo, the drowning man. And check out Michel Rebagliati's new book, The Song of Roland. He will be at Toronto Comics Arts Festival, TCAF, this weekend. You're tuned into Books for Breakfast. We've got a great show coming up. We're pretty soon going to talk to Kate McQuaid from A House of Anansi Press. She's the publicist there, and she's a wunderkind. I've worked with her a few times in the Massey Lecture. She's a great organizer, and boy, is she ever doing a good job. They've currently got the Governor General's winner, Patrick DeWitt, on their list. It's, you know, names like Lisa Moore, Rawi Hodge, Leap Out, and of course they foster the Massey Lecture books and publications every year. They have expanded recently to include an international imprint called Anansi International, and also a crime imprint called Spiderline. And they also, not so long ago, acquired one of the best, for my money, one of the best kids publishers in this country, Groundwood Books. So You know, hands down, they are doing incredible work, and I would say I'd give them a BFB, big double thumbs up to say that, you know, they are number one, I think, in this country right now. So we'll talk to Kate McQuaid, and then soon after that, we're going to talk to Carrie Snyder about her wonderful new book, The Juliet Stories. But before that, here's something crunchy to listen to on Books for Breakfast. Just before you heard me talking just before that about one of the best presses in Canada right now, House of Nancy Press. It got going in 1967 under the auspices of two writers, Dennis Lee of Alligator Pie. Dennis Lee, did you know that? And David David Godfrey, two amazing kickstart young men who ended up publishing people like Margaret Atwood, Michael Ondaatje, Northrop Frye, Matt Cohen, names like that in the 60s. And House of Nancy has just been getting better and better since. And if we're lucky, we have publicist Kate McQuaid on the phone with us today. Kate, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Hey, thanks for joining us this morning. Is this early for you or no?
No, it's not early.
Excellent. So maybe we could just start off. You could tell us a little bit about your role at Anansi. What does a publicist do, and when did you join? And maybe walk us through sort of a typical day in your life at this office.
Yeah, well, I've been here 5 years in July, and I started as Laura Repass's assistant, and she was the publicity director and still is. And basically, my job is to get the books reviewed in the media and authors out in front of a readership. So the best part of the job is talking to the media, pitching the books, and sort of building a condensed, maybe 2 or 3 week tour. You know, and most of the travel does take place in the fall, so it's sort of a lopsided year because it's pretty busy in September and October. So that's the most fun stuff. And then the typical day, I mean, it's a lot of email, it's a lot of phone calls, and it's a lot of lunches and, just sort of meeting with people. It's a very, personable job, I guess. It's a very social job.
Hey, do you have time to get to know each of these writers? Is that part of the gig?
Yeah, well, that's the good thing about Anansi, right? I've heard us described as a boutique publisher, and I think that's making us sound smaller than we are.
Right.
But I do kind of like the idea of a smaller feel. So yeah, we do get to know each of our writers, and you know, everywhere from editorial to production to publicity and sales, it's very much. I wanted to say family. That sounds pretty cheesy, but it is. It's a very all hands on deck kind of environment.
Yeah, you know, I don't think that's cheesy, because I mean, I've been a bookseller for almost a decade. You know, House of Anansi was always on my radar, even as like a, I guess as a, maybe as a collector of fine volumes of poetry or something like that. But then
yeah,
as soon as Bill Douglas got hired to redesign, to make the Anansi logo and to sort of
right,
set the standard of bright colors and amazing photography and just good all round design.
I'm glad you think that.
It was just hard to not notice Anansi books, you know, and things have just been going so well, don't you think?
Yes, they have been going really well. Especially, I mean, nothing better than last year, really. It's the Sisters Brothers, Patrick DeWitt, Lynn Cody, the antagonist, the Adam Gopnik Massey lecture, you know, just to name a few off the top of my head. We just had a great year. And, you know, obviously a lot of it is down to Sarah McLaughlin, who's our president and publisher. And, of course, our owner, Scott Griffin.
Yes, two visionaries, hey? Is it?
Yeah.
Do you have that? Is that kind of underpinning your everyday operation? Is that a firmament on which you stand? You know, do you think about the rich history of this press as you go about your day, or is it? Do you get kind of a bit more lost in the mundane?
Well, you know, the truthful answer might be yes. It is kind of at the forefront, and part of that is because I think. You know, a good work culture comes from the top down, right? And there's about 25 of us in the office, and our leadership is great, and it's sort of lots of fun. And I know that they're always thinking of that. An example of it might be sort of how it's in the forefront is this year is our 45th anniversary.
Congratulations.
Thank you. So this fall we're publishing, or republishing, I should say, 8 sort of very classic Anansi books. And they do have these beautiful, very sort of young redesigns, and they're super cheap. So we're trying to get them sort of at a student market that maybe doesn't know them. It's like Survival by Margaret Atwood, Civil Elegies by Dennis Lee, Poems for All the Annettes by Al Purdy, which is, you know, one of my very favorite poets, sort of near and dear to my heart.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, The Outlander, Kimaraska by Annie Bear. So, you know, there's a
what a list
that we're redoing.
That's amazing.
And that'll be a big marketing push.
Yeah, Civil Elegies is the first the first Anansi book I ever bought, and I think that's a gorgeous book. People know Dennis Lee for his sort of rollicking, silly, but amazing kids rhymes. But gosh, is he ever a tender poet for adults as well? Isn't he?
Yeah, he is. He's great. And he starts his emails, "Yo, Kate."
Yo.
Yo. So, it's a pleasure to work with, too.
So you say you've got 25 people in the office. I can imagine days in Anansi's history where there were, you know, two people over stacks of books. So things are really expanding. That includes, you know, in the last few years, Anansi has done a pretty great job of acquiring some international rights for titles under the banner of Anansi International. And also, I'm pretty excited about writers like Ian Hamilton under the Spiderline imprint. What's going on here? Are you guys ambitious or just excited? Or what is it? Can you let us in on the plan and the rapid expansion?
Well, I think it's definitely ambition and excitement, for sure. And I think that, you know, it's always been important to Anansi to sort of reflect the Canadian cultural landscape. And that is international, actually. And that's what we want to read. It's sort of in the market, there's a lot of appetite for books, you know, from Europe or from America or from, you know, different areas of the world. And that's kind of what we like to read, too, in addition to a more traditional Canadiana. So, I think we're just kind of moving with the times, especially the crime fiction stuff. I mean, that's there's sort of an explosion of that in the market. And we can do that well, too. One thing that I think we're committed to across all our imprints is a really high standard of literary quality. So that holds for the crime fiction as well. we've got this book this fall, which is probably the one I'm the most excited about, called Zagreb Cowboy. And it's a new crime fiction series by this man, Ellen Matic, who's living in London. And it takes place in Yugoslavia during the early 90s, and it involves a secret police, this detective called Marco Della Torre. And he kind of escapes hitmen through Croatia, Italy, and ends up in London. So, like, that's just sort of a fun story.
That sounds great.
And I'm looking forward to that this fall.
Is Marco kind of a tough guy, or...
he's kind of like a sexy tough guy, a sexy secret police, you know.
That seems like a winning formula.
Yeah, I hope so.
Okay, well, that's amazing. That's really what I wanted to close on. I was just going to ask you maybe if there's anything else. That's what you're excited about in the fall. Is there anything you think listeners should really spend some time and dig off the shelf from the spring list, the current list?
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, it sort of depends what you like. But, of course, Carrie Snyder's book.
All right.
The Juliet Stories is sort of... She's exactly the kind of author I think Anansi likes to publish, because her writing is of a very high, beautiful quality. Like, each sentence is sort of a craft.
Yeah.
And it's very creative, both in, diction and plot. So there's kind of a suspense there that keeps you going, and it just feels like a high-quality experience to read it.
Plus, she's got that quintessential Canadian formula of telling her novels in short stories.
Yeah,
which is
exactly.
People love
exactly.
that.
And I have to say, she's pretty plugged in online. And, you know, that is wonderful if an author can come to the house with sort of an online community already there.
Right.
And she's got a blog called Obscure Canlit Mama, which is lots of fun about raising her four kids as a writer. So, Carrie's book is great. Lynn Crosby, the Globe and Mail columnist, has an absolutely, like, blow-your-head-off, incredibly beautiful, grotesque, kind of fantastical memoir blend of fiction called Life is About Losing Everything. And it kind of reminds me of Anne Sexton, and I like to read that stuff. So I'm also very personally excited about Lynn Crosby.
I agree. That's a gorgeous book. You sent the store a couple galleys, and I had a chance to go through it. And it's this cornucopia of all of her styles: journalism and autobiography, but also dreams and almost nightmares and horror. And she's a wonderful writer.
Well, yeah, I'm glad you think so.
Absolutely. You're doing a great job, Kate. The list is incredible. It's really good to talk to you. I think if you're okay with that, we'll make this sort of a sometimes check-in to see how Anansi's doing. And we actually have...
I would love it, Dan. You're so great. And of course, we just adore the bookshelf.
Right on. Well, me too. Thanks, Kate.
Okay.
Good luck with the season, and thanks for coming on the show this morning.
Oh, no problem. Thanks for having me. I'll talk to you soon.
Okay,
thanks,
take care.
Okay, bye.
Bye-bye. That's Kate McQuaid from House of Anansi Press. She's the publicist there. She's a stellar publicist, but she's also a great reader. And if you want to take any book recommendations away today, then I would probably seek that Lynn Crosby book out. Luckily, we have Carrie Snyder coming up on the show, so we can flesh that recommendation out. And also, Kate mentions Zagreb Cowboy, coming up in the fall by Alan Murdoch.
Pour pas me coucher, de se tenir dans mon joint, c'est ton calvaire, sa couleur de l'espoir.
måste klara ut. Vi ser om jag är god eller inte, det tror du inte bra i. Det ser jag rätt på en hållit. Vi ser om jag är god eller inte, det tror du inte bra i. Det ser jag rätt på en hållit.
You're tuned in to Books for Breakfast. That's 93.3 FM in Guelph. Thanks for listening. And you just heard our little interview with Kate McQuaid from House of Anansi Press. House of Anansi is a fantastic press, and they always have a good lineup, but especially this season. They have a book that I think is going to make a bunch of awards lists this year, The Juliet Stories by Carrie Snyder. If you haven't had a chance to, it just came out in March, so no shame if you haven't had a chance to see it yet, but please do make sure to check it out. Carrie Snyder's actually coming to town. She's coming through Guelph Monday, May 7th. That's this coming Monday at the E-Bar, 7 p.m. with fellow short story writer Andrew Hood, who's published on Invisible and who you may have heard last week here on Books for Breakfast. But in just a few moments, we're going to actually give Carrie a call. She's over in Waterloo. She's a novelist, blogger, a mom. She's a runner. She's a wunderkind. She's an amazing writer. In 2004, she published her first novel, and it was a novel and stories called Hair Hat. That came out with Penguin, and she was actually nominated for the Danuta Gleed Award for that. That's the one that Andrew won. Hmm. Yeah. So that's an amazing prize for short fiction. And then in March this year, she published her second book, this time with House of Anansi. It's Juliet Stories. It's an amazing story of, I guess it's a family saga is sort of the summary, but it focuses on a character named Juliet Friesen, the character of the title, who as a 10-year-old is taken with her parents to Managua, Nicaragua. It's the 1980s, and her parents are part of a group that's resisting Reagan's foreign policy, and there's a whole bunch of mess going on between the Contras and the Sandinistas. But Juliet is 10, so she doesn't, you know, she doesn't quite understand all of this. They're there for a year and a half or 2 years. Some things go wrong in the family, including her brother Keith gets sick, and they move back to what's sort of like Waterloo, Ontario, somewhere in southern Ontario. And the second half of the book, the nine stories that make up the back part, are much more about Juliet sort of coming of age and all of the things that happen to a young person's life. It's an amazing collection, and it's one of these incredible Canadian artifacts that leaps through time to be a novel, but really it could be read a chapter at a time, a story at a time.
It sounds fantastic. Yeah. We'll be on the phone with Carrie Snyder in just a couple minutes. Was there anything else you wanted to?
No, yeah. I'm excited to talk to her. Yeah, I think she's going to be a rising star on our scene here. This is Books for Breakfast. I'm your host, Dan Evans, and I'm joined by Peter Bradley. And this is a book nerd show that comes out of Guelph every Thursday morning. And we always try to check in with the up-and-comers and the rising stars in this world. And today we're lucky enough to be joined, I hope she's on the phone, by Waterloo writer Carrie Snyder, whose new book, The Juliet Stories, has been released just this March with House of Anansi Press. Carrie, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Hey, thanks for joining us. Is this changing your morning schedule, or... Is this okay?
I sent the kids off early to school.
Excellent.
But otherwise, no. Having my cup of coffee.
Well, first off, let me just say you've written a beautiful book, and congratulations.
Thank you very much.
I hope you make 1,000 awards lists this year.
Well, me too.
Yeah. It's not long on the shelves. It's still steaming, in fact. So maybe for listeners who haven't had a chance to check out the Juliet stories, you could just tell us in your own words what you think this book is about.
Well, it's about a family whose parents are peace activists. And they make a fairly radical decision to move from their comfortable North American lives to go and live in a country that is experiencing a war. So it's set in Nicaragua in the 1980s during the Contra War. And it's mostly about Juliet, or from the perspective of Juliet, who is 10 years old. So obviously that gives a kind of different flavor to the telling of the political stuff that's going on.
Yeah. I mean, you remember a couple seasons ago, the big news was Emma Donoghue, who could sustain the voice of a 5-year-old in her book Room,
and that's right.
It tore through the international bestseller list, and she was universally praised for being somebody who could get inside the brain of a young person. And I think you have the same talent. I think you've done an amazing job at sort of filtering what can be danger,
yep.
Sometimes what can be just plain excitement and confusion, and also just all those dynamics, you know, of the adults in the other room having a party, and you know there's something going on. There's backstabbing, and there's also, you know, you've done a great job of making this a 10-year-old's world. So how did you do that? How did you get inside the brain of a 10-year-old?
I don't know. I think there's a lot of me and Juliet, at least in the younger Nicaraguan Juliet. I was much like that as a child, as a sort of an observer. And I actually see my own daughter doing that too. She likes to listen in, and I was very similar to that. So I don't know. I just kind of go into my characters as I'm writing them.
Well, how else did you prepare for this book? Because you and your family did spend a bit of time in Nicaragua. Did you already know the history there of the Contra War, or did you have to research it?
A bit of both. So this is loosely based on my own experiences as a child. I obviously created fiction out of it, but when I was a child, my parents did exactly what Juliet's parents did, and they took us to Nicaragua. I was the oldest of 4 children. And I was 9 at the time. So obviously there's a lot to draw on in terms of my own memories of the, you know, sensual stuff and the smells and the sounds and just what it felt like to be there. It stayed with me. We were only there for a short while, about 14 months, but it obviously stayed with me as a very primary experience in my life. So when I started thinking about writing about Nicaragua, yes, I did go and do a fair bit of research about the Contra War, about the politics of the time. There's a lot of information out there.
Yeah.
Nothing sort of coherent or an overall view has been written, but there's lots of material. People were very interested in it at the time.
I mean, as your reader now, and not really a student of history, I'm definitely interested in the conflict, but I think what we were talking about before with getting in the brain of a 10-year-old, what you do so amazingly is situate a lot of the more political events off camera, so to speak. And, you know, like Juliet and Keith and Gloria don't often go to the front where the real activity is. And so, therefore, in a way, the reader is like a bit more like the confused child in the background.
Yep.
So do you... I was satisfied with descriptions of, you know, these barrios or the rusty park or, you know, whatever, you know, in town things that Juliet, the going to the library, for example.
Yes.
But do you feel like you got to know the stories of the Sandinistas and the Contras and really understand the sort of American conflict at the time? Or is that even important?
Well, I do think it was important for me to get a deeper grasp of it. But I'll tell you, it took a lot of drafts to take that material out, because to write about it really overtly wrecks the story.
Right.
I wasn't trying to write a history. And so it took a number of drafts to sort of file back what I did know and you know, take some stuff out. But I hope that the layers of knowledge are there underneath, kind of informing the stories. But yeah, I wasn't trying to write a history. And there's so many sides to this story that it was easier to tell it from Juliet's point of view. I think I would have a really hard time writing it as an actual history.
Yeah.
Just because there's so many sides. And I think one of my jobs as a writer is to see a lot of sides rather than pick a side. And that's not something obviously Juliet's family was doing. They were more picking a side.
Right.
Yeah.
Did the Roots of Justice, this is the group that they're part of, are they modeled on a real group, or did you just kind of conjure that?
No, they're modeled on a real group. They're modeled on the group that my parents worked for.
Okay.
I mean, loosely modeled, but yes. And actually, there were quite a number of nonprofit organizations there when we were there. It was a very bustling time for international organizations to go and help out.
So we're kind of mostly talking. We're still in this. The first part of the book here, and I love what you've done here. This is your second time telling a novel in stories, and I know you're attentive to having each of the stories stand alone. How do you go about this? Did this take you 10 years? Do you publish some of these stories in literary journals first?
Yes, I did.
Yeah.
Yep. It was a long process. It was probably about 6 years of writing. And to be honest, I actually tried to make it a novel first. So it wasn't as successful as a novel. So I found myself going back to my story roots. And one of the chapters in the book, actually the last one in the Nicaragua section, I actually wrote probably 7 years ago, and it was published in a very different form. Different character names, sort of a different... It was different, but I went back to that story, and that's a really important story in the book, crucial.
Is that Amulets you're talking about?
Amulets. And I wrote... So I rewrote that one, and then I also wrote the very first story in the book, Rat, which sort of introduces us to what it... You know, that sort of entry into this scene in Nicaragua.
And it even sets the tone of that first section, because that's where Juliet kind of gets called a rat by their host family.
That's
and where she first learns that really there are dangers outside of this new home that they've got, and they can easily get lost in a new place in language or in, you know, physicality.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yep.
Okay, so that's amazing. So you really crafted existing stories to fit Juliet's.
I did in some ways, and then, you know, as the book progressed, as it got bigger and I saw the larger story, then what I did was I basically just filled them in. I filled parts in, or I would say, oh, this needs something here, or I want to know more about this part of her life here.
Okay, well, let's talk a bit about that, because in a way, I think one of the amazing talents you have is not filling in some of the, not talking down to the reader. You know, having this story presented as fragments also lets the reader fill in the time gaps in between each story. Is that your intention?
Yeah, I think I'm the kind of reader who likes to read books that it's not all clearly laid out for me, that there's still some puzzling out to be done. So I think that's the kind of writer I strive to be as well. And I really do trust the reader. Like, I trust that the leaps are going to be made and that they're going to put it together and draw out of it what sort of what they need. I think stories should speak to the reader on their own terms rather than telling the reader what to think.
Well, thank you as a reader, because it really works here. I really liked what Zoe Whittle said in her review. She sort of marks the two parts of the book with time. You know, the first part where when you're in Nicaragua is an unfolding more of day-to-day events. You know, you get just a year and a half in Juliet's life. And then should we spoil some of these plot things? Something bad happens to the family near the end of the first section.
That's right.
Her brother is ill. Keith, her middle brother, is ill. And the family leaves to go back to Ontario. And then your speed changes.
Yeah.
Yeah, and Zoe Whittle kind of says, you know, at that point, you just decide to hit the major events in sort of a life, like marriage, death, birth.
Yes.
Yeah. So what's going on there in the gear shift? Is that a tactic on the reader, or is that just coincidental?
I don't think it probably should have been more deliberate, perhaps. But, I think the second section is called Disruption. So when I was thinking about it and putting it together, I was thinking about the the disruptions that happen. I mean, there's the disruption of childhood as you become an adult, and then there are various disruptions that happen throughout one's life. So I think, in a sense, in the second half, I kind of force the reader to be a bit disrupted in the reading experience.
Yeah, and it's true. We're actually jostled out of Juliet's brain sometimes because whereas in the first section, a lot of the observations come through her, you open up the voices in the second part.
You know, they really just wanted to be told.
Okay.
Yeah, there's one story in particular called The Four Corners of the House.
Great story.
Yeah, and that one, really, it just had to be written, and that was how it had to be written. It felt like a sort of, you know, transcendental experience of some sort, just writing it. I really felt like I was just telling the story for these characters. I was listening to them and just letting them tell me what they were feeling and thinking. It was a very difficult story to write, actually. I wrote it over a couple of very intense days, and I would literally write all day, and then I would go to a yoga class, and I remember just laying there in yoga and like just kind of letting the voices wash into me, and then I'd go home and write some more.
Amazing.
Yeah.
I just from, you know, the months that I've been reading your blog, it seems to me that that is actually kind of your MO. You sort of let your daily life leak into your creative life.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I think it's all part of the same thing. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, in the second part of the book, in the disruption part, you kind of age Juliet through tragedies. I mean, they're not just tragedies. They're more like major life happenings.
Yes.
The women characters in your books are so strong. I hate to force you. I know fiction is fiction, but are these kind of mapped off your own major life events, or you know, how did you decide to age Juliet through, say, an abortion and a marriage and a second marriage for her mom and, you know, things like that, the death of her brother? Why did you pick those?
I don't even know. I think when I think about Juliet, the first section to me is, I would say she's much more me. And the second section, she kind of goes in her own direction. I think I picked those events because they're dramatic and they're interesting to write about as much as anything. I kind of wish it were easier to write about really, really happy things.
Yeah.
I would love to do that. I haven't figured it out yet.
Oh, I think you have.
I love that wedding story. I have to say that the second marriage, and she's a 19-year-old in that story. And I loved writing that story. That was, again, a story where I felt like I was just following this character around, kind of listening in, kind of fly on the wall. And it was, you know, nothing like my own experience, but I loved writing it.
Well, it comes off, you know, you can really tell she's a bit grumpy and, you know, she really resists this happening, more the ceremony than the happiness of her mom. She doesn't actually mind Jesse that much, but she doesn't really enjoy the ceremony of a wedding.
Yes.
And you could really feel the 19-year-old there, you know?
Exactly. Yeah, it was fun.
So I think you have figured out how to transfer different emotions, and part of that, I think, comes through your blogging. I mean, can we talk just quickly about that? You blog as Obscure Canlit Mama, which is great. And there's a hell of an archive there. You've been doing it for a while.
I have.
You've been raising four kids. You know, how does that fit into your day and your job?
Well, the blogging started. I had four kids, and my youngest was pretty much newborn, and I was getting zero writing time. Like, just nothing, no creative writing time at all, and I was kind of going crazy. And I knew people who blogged, and I'll admit I kind of looked down on it just a little bit. So it seemed a little too easy that you could just write something and then push publish, and it's out there.
Yeah.
But I tried it one morning. I had a little bit of time, but I didn't really have time to do anything significant. So I just thought, okay, I'm just going to see what this is like. And it was just what I needed, really, because I need to write pretty much every day, but there isn't always some big project that I'm working on. So for me, it's such a pleasure, I have to say. I love writing the blog. It's a very light writing for me, but I think it's also, it has actually helped my craft, I think, and it has made me more, aware of boundaries, of audience, who you're speaking to, of the things that you really want to say. Because in a blog, a good blog post is usually relatively brief and to the point, and you're sort of shaping something fairly quickly, but around a very simple, easy-to-grasp theme.
Yeah.
And I think that's helpful for any kind of writing.
Okay, well, it has made you a flexible writer, that's for sure, because I think of your blogs as, I feel very included in your blogs. They're very conversational. You even give us recipes, you know,
that's right.
And yet I don't think you spend all that much time with dialogue in your fiction writing, you know, and so I find you're very able to leap in and out of sort of swaths of dialogue or swaths of description or interior monologues. And I think probably having to organize your thoughts in 200 word bursts at a time has helped that.
Oh, I think so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, this is such an amazing book. You cover so much of one person's life, and there are other great characters that we didn't even get a chance to talk about. Is there anything you want to leave readers with in terms of, what are you proud of about this book or of about creating Juliet the character?
Well, I think this was a good book for me to write. I felt very compassionate toward the characters. I think I wrote it in exactly the kind of spirit that I want to write my fiction and my blogs and whatever I'm writing, which is just being very open to the experiences of others, whether they're fictional characters or real people. And that's how I approached writing the stories. And I don't know, I feel like it came across. I feel like that's what's expressed.
I think it did, Carrie. It's great to have you on the show today. Thanks so much, and all the best with the Juliet stories. Before you sign off, do you think you could treat us to a little reading, just a little taste?
Sure.
Okay.
I was thinking of reading a section very early on where Juliet is talking about what they're doing in Nicaragua.
Okay.
Is that okay?
Go for it.
Okay.
So this is Carrie Snyder reading from her new book, The Juliet Stories.
It is February 1984. Ronald Reagan is the president of the United States of America. He is fighting the commies. Commie is short for communist, a thick plank of a word that is used often and ominously on American television. On American television, communist means evil. But Juliet takes her definition from Gloria, her mother, who says that communists are people who share everything. Imagine fighting against people who share. It is the punchline to a joke. Juliet writes a skit on the subject, and Keith plays Ronald Reagan with gusto. I declare a war on sharing. There will be no more sharing. Juliet loves and craves definitions. What is the specific meaning of each heavy word that falls from the sky? But a definition is not an answer. It is a temporary shelter, a camp that is put up and broken down. The more she knows, the frailer the originally stable definition, as its meaning comes stamping into her brain, shadowed with everything it has been and will ever be, everything connected to it. Nicaragua is a country shaped like a triangle where it is hot and never snows. Also, they are having a war. Managua is the capital city, where it is safe to live except for the volcanoes and the earthquakes. The Sandinistas are in charge, and they might be commies, but that would be okay. See definition of a communist. The Cold War is America versus the USSR. Somehow this matters, even though Nicaragua is neither of those places. The CIA are scary Americans who sneak around and do bad things, playing nasty tricks on people. They might be anywhere, even pretending to work for the Roots of Justice. The Roots of Justice is going to stop the fighting in Nicaragua. Juliet's parents work for the Roots of Justice. They will bring Americans into Nicaragua to protest against the Contra War. Freedom fighters, what Ronald Reagan calls the Contras. The Contras, masked men who stab Nicaraguan babies with bayonets, which are knives attached to the ends. Turning page. The ends of their guns. The Contra War. The Contras are fighting against the Sandinista government. Ronald Reagan is paying, but nobody knows. Everyone needs to know. A protest is a way of telling, yelling, when no one is listening. Pay attention. Juliet's parents believe they can stop the Contra. At least, they believe they have to try. That is why the Friesen family have come to Nicaragua. They have come to stop Ronald Reagan. They will take ordinary Americans to the border towns where Contras ambush and murder ordinary Nicaraguans. The ordinary Americans will not let that happen. They will stand peaceful and strong in between. They will wear matching green t-shirts and they will hold hands and sing songs. They won't get hurt. Ronald Reagan and his freedom fighters won't want to hurt ordinary Americans. Juliet would like to go too, to stand in the line and hold hands and sing. Juliet's mother says she won't be able to. Juliet will stay with her brothers in Managua, where it is safe and no one is being killed. I'll stop there.
That's amazing. That's Carrie Snyder giving us a little taste of the character Juliet Friesen, a 10-year-old who's with her family in Nicaragua, and that's from her new book, The Juliet Stories. Thanks so much, Carrie, for being here. Look forward to seeing you in Guelph on Monday at the E-Bar.
Yay!
And all the best with a great book.
Thanks so much, Dan. I'm looking forward to meeting you in person.
Yeah, it'll be fun to be on stage together.
Great.
Take care, Carrie.
Okay, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
That's it for Books for Breakfast this week. That's Carrie Snyder and Kate McQuaid, both from Anansi. Carrie's new book, The Juliet Stories, is a novel in stories. It's an amazing story about the Friesens, and they're bopping all over the place. They go from Canada down to Nicaragua and back to Canada, and lots of emotional highs and lows in this book. And Carrie is going to be in Guelph this Monday, 7 p.m. at the E-Bar with Andrew Hood. So come on out. It's a free event. They're both going to give readings, and there's time for a Q&A. It's always nice to celebrate new books.
And if you missed last week's show, we had Andrew Hood in here, so check the archives at cfru.ca for that. We have a few great interviews coming up in the coming weeks. Stephen Hennigan and Dan Wells from Biblioasis coming on for May 10th next week, May 17th. Travel writer,
yes,
Sarah Wheeler, and May 24th, essayist John Jeremiah Sullivan.
Oh, man.
It'll be a good month on Books for Breakfast, right here on CFRU.